following program is a production of KHNS. Its content does not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the Board of Directors and staff of Lynn Cannell Broadcasting Incorporated, the licensee.
Talk Around Town is supported in part by Community Waste Solutions, offering comprehensive refuse services for the community of Haines, with curbside pickup to South Hall, composting to recycling, C&D disposal to septic and porta potty services. Community Waste Solutions at the end of FAA Road in Haines, open 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Monday through Saturday.
Welcome to Talk Around Town. I'm Deborah Schnabel, your guide through today's talk about things that matter. Our current news analysis with Tom Morfitt is coming up, and our talking topic is public access to ocean resources. What options does a developing community have? Our guests will be Haynesboro Mayor Stephanie Scott, Attorney Richard Folta, and community activist Fred Einsbrook. We'll check in with the Southeast Alaska State Fair, and hey, who are you? Introduces us to another community member. Stay tuned for Talk Around Town. And a good day to you, Tom. How are you?
Good, Deb. Good. It's a great day to be in the news business.
And why is that?
Well, it's just May is just bursting out all over with news.
I did see you down on the Portage Cove area this morning.
Oh, yeah,
with
you
your camera.
There. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sprained my ankle. This was a great moment in photojournalism. My wife goes, "You better get your camera down here. That looks like maybe the whole fort's burning down." I just turned in for the night. Haven't been up all night putting out the paper. And so I stumbled out and I twisted my ankle.
Ooh, for real?
I kind of turned it. I have a trick ankle. And I had my wife's point and shoot. My shoes weren't tied. And then I run over there to the fire. And then right there next to me, a person steps through a rotten plank. And we had like another emergency, but it's been that kind of week. It's one thing.
Well,
after another.
Everyone, I'm sure, is on there on pins and needles. What fire?
I was going to say.
I mean, what kind of reporter are you?
Oh my
what
word!
What fire, Tom?
See? Yeah. Well,
that's okay. You're very tired.
The there was a fire today. It looked like the whole fort was going to go down, or up. About 7:30, you looked up in the air downtown, and great billowing
black.
Black and flames shooting up, and it was just an outbuilding belonging to our man
Leo
Smith. Yeah, and Leo is out burning weeds this morning.
I'm sure it was more than just an outbuilding. I'm sure his life's collection of tools was in there, wasn't it?
Well, you know, Georgianne said it was not the greatest. I mean, it was obviously a loss for them, but they were taking it very philosophically. There was freezers, there were some tools in there, but their house was okay. And most importantly, the fire, even though it was fairly windy, didn't spread anywhere because a lot of old, dry buildings here in the fort. And as you recall, our business, the Chilkat Valley News, fell
victim to
a big fire that we still have the remains of today. So, it's been just a crazy week that we went from the alleged murder last week. We were just getting done with that. And we had our flash mobs and our graduation and our promotion. And we got our King Salmon Derby coming and the reading program and all these things.
This might sound
and then
like
we
old
had a
hat to
bomb
you.
Last night, a supposed bomb, a discovered, reported at the library book bin. Mm-hmm. It might have been one of these things like a 9-year-old boy goes to his friend, like, "Let's put together a bomb," and you kind of wire all this stuff together. And like every kid who's ever lived, you know, when he hits about 9 years old, just is fascinated by things that go boom or light on fire. So I'm not sure that it's not something like this. But the cop said it could have caught fire. It looked like maybe it was an attempted incendiary device.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the book bin at the library.
Well, sure. I didn't like those books.
Fahrenheit 451.
Right.
So, yeah. So, and it's May. And May is, May and July, I guess, are our big months in terms of news. Everybody wants to go outside. Everybody wants to have, you know, we have the school year ending. We have the summer officially beginning with the Salmon Derby. Mm-hmm. So it's, and the Beer Fest weekend. So it's over the top.
So school was out yesterday, right? It was the last day of school.
Day
so today is the first day of summer vacation.
Mm-hmm.
So we will, you know, have a lot of demographic shift in the community now. A lot of people coming in for summer jobs and a lot of people going out for vacations and seeing family and friends and, you know, fishing.
Yeah.
Yeah, all of those things.
But the big story of the week
was
broken right here at KHNS by my colleague Margaret, which is a local guide, Ron Martin. Who had run-ins with laws for years involving guiding practices, has signed an agreement, basically pleading a plea agreement involving five felony counts.
Now, how do you know that it was a plea agreement? I mean, I know that he is pleading guilty, but do you know what how that works
there's
out?
Actually
so let's pull Margaret into this.
Oh, well, Tom has the story too, but it's timing. Sometimes I run the story before it comes out in the newspaper because of timing. But yeah, because it's federal counts, the U.S. District Court does have public court documents online.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's not like we have any information that attorneys say is not, you know, is privileged. It's just,
I was curious about the plea bargaining part.
The plea bargaining is filed in district court, and the U.S. attorney said that Mr. Martin goes to Juneau court on the 31st to supposedly enter his formal plea.
May
31st, and enter the plea. And the agreement's already signed, but there's some formalities to finalize it. So, but the plea agreement is there in the public court documents that detail what the, you know, U.S. attorney charges Mr. Martin with and what he's agreeing to plead guilty to and everything like that.
So. And it should be said, this is a big effort by these law enforcement agencies. This involves collaboration between the state and the federal agents. Started a year and a half ago with a kind of a big raid in Haines.
Yes, I remember.
Several locations. So
and a lot of equipment was confiscated.
Yeah, probably as much of a police action as ever happens in this town, really. Federal felony counts. It's a pretty serious case. And it's aimed, it turns out it's kind of aimed at permanently revoking Mr. Martin's guiding license.
And the charges are, just a refresher.
Falsifying hunt records.
Wildlife trafficking.
Illegal take of, I think, a goat in Canada. And then the Lacey Act, a federal law called the Lacey Act kicks in here. If you take an animal illegally and then you transport it over the federal border. I'm not sure if it has to be state and federal or just a state border. But anyway, it invokes this penalty of federal law. And so pretty serious stuff, yeah.
Okay. Margaret, do you have anything to add to that then?
No, he pretty much covered it.
Okay.
I mean, it is federal charge. Yeah, it's a lot of federal wildlife stuff that are criminal charges. So.
But the bear taking incident that you had spoken about earlier with me, that there was brown bears taken when
at unregistered black bear bait stations.
Okay.
It's my understanding you're not supposed to take brown bears at any bait stations. You know, sometimes hunters go to the bait stations and they see the brown bear. And I know, didn't the Board of Game have recent discussions about trying to change some of this too?
Right. I think there was a discussion of baiting brown bears, which hasn't been done previously.
Okay.
But
Okay.
And and the other thing I guess that makes this part time of the year dramatic is that, you know, our weather goes bing one day and it's summer.
Uh-huh.
Our track team ran last Saturday in Fairbanks in 20-degree weather. And and this week we'll probably we're supposed to see maybe high 60s by Saturday, mm-hmm. and the winds die down. Mm-hmm. So there is an argument that we really don't have a spring here.
this spring was a difficult one. That's for sure. Summer we had snow up till the end, but the Hooligan are in and out already.
Yeah,
and,
great mm-hmm, Hooligan mm-hmm, year. Mm-hmm, yeah, folks in Clermont say they have. Everything and more that they need in terms
terrific.
Of Hooligan. And a couple, I just want to do a shout out to Annalise Stacy, mm-hmm. who just retired last year from the Head Start. And she, Annalise, in more than 25 years there, worked every single job. There was about mm-hmm. seven different jobs, mm-hmm. including driving the bus and cooking. And she was the head teacher. She was the director of the program. And it's a great little program they mm-hmm. have down there at the Head Start now, which has kind mm-hmm. of evolved the last mm-hmm. 20 years. If you don't have a young kid, you may not have noticed, but mm-hmm. it's a great program.
Terrific. And while we're giving kudos to people, I did note that Cheryl Stickler, our principal at the school, mm-hmm. Has been honored with a national acknowledgement, right?
Yeah, there's one per state. And now it's going to... Because it was last week. I'm going to remember the name of the organization.
Every 2 weeks, Tom. Oh, right. So you have to cover 2 weeks at a time. Jeez. We haven't mentioned that the principal of the Haynes Elementary School has been identified as a superior principal here.
And just last fall, under Principal Stickler, the school won that statewide award for bringing all those kids up to speed.
Mm-hmm. Reading.
Well, uh-huh. and reading is the basis of all learning. So the district has really gotten after that, and it seems like it's kind of groundbreaking. Mm-hmm. And it takes latest research. We got to get these kids at the younger age, help them to read, and get their parents reading to them in very early ages, or talking and communicating with them and mm-hmm. expressing full ideas, and. So that's been a real feather in the cap for the district, that we're kind of on that leading edge of mm-hmm. research and then implementation.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Tom. And it's a great day, and you get out, and after you take your nap, go ahead. We should probably clarify, Tom usually gets his newspaper out on Wednesday night before 1 o'clock, but you had new software installed and you struggled all night long with putting the paper together.
Well, it's funny.
I think that's interesting.
Well, I called up the guy that is the genius that prints our paper, and I said, this machine's not working. He goes, your program, you've now bought a program that is way smarter than your dumb machine. So you have to buy, now after buying all these programs, I have to buy a smarter machine.
All right.
Because my machine is too dumb for the program.
Jeez. All right. Well, welcome to 2013, Tom. Thanks very much for stopping by. We'll see you in 2 weeks. access to water resources, especially the ocean, for subsistence harvesting and recreation. It's an important need in our environment. As private ownership of land increases and development intensifies, access to the ocean becomes a public policy issue. With me today to discuss this important property issue is attorney and land surveyor Richard Folta, Mayor Stephanie Scott, and advocate Fred Einsbrook. Welcome to all of you. Thanks for coming in today. Our topic's going to be a little bit, I found it to be somewhat complex, I guess, as I started to work through thinking about what it was that I wanted to, you know, bring out and discuss today. But I think that most of us feel the impact of the increasing rate of development of privately held land here in the Haynesboro. Areas that appeared to be open land are no longer open to entry due to structures being built on the land. And, of course, the owners of the land have rights to develop their land. And today we want to explore the conflict between private ownership and public access. And this is most, as I said, most keenly experienced along the waterfront, because the water is a source of recreation. It's a source of subsistence. And it's where we launch our boats to get into the water. And it's also access to public tidelands, because the beach, the land below mean high tide, is owned by all of us collectively. So we need to have access to it. So I'd like to just start with Portage Cove. And Stephanie, I know that you were not the mayor at the time that we that the borough began the process to acquire what we call Picture Point or Nuktic Point. But we have just recently spent $90,000 an acre to acquire about 5 acres here in Portage Cove area, as we call it Nuktic Point. It has a breathtaking view of the town site. We understand that. But another argument for acquisition was public access. Can you justify that acquisition as a just a public policy issue? You look like you're on the spot. Don't mean to put you on the spot there.
Can but I justify just, it?
Yeah.
As a, well, you, as member of the assembly, voted to adopt that piece of land. And can I justify it as a public policy issue? Well, in this case, it seems to be an issue related to economic development of the entire downtown tourist region. And so in that case, I think I can justify it. I do support buying it as opposed to taking possession of it through adverse possession, which we probably could have done, or some kind of eminent domain. I don't like those laws that are in fact in place in the state of Alaska and elsewhere. So the way we acquired it, I think, is ethical and proper.
Purchase, sure.
By purchase, right, and as opposed to taking possession of it, because certainly it has been historically used by the community for various recreation and economic reasons. I think tour companies pull out there and offer their tourists this iconic picture of the Fort Seward. Mm-hmm. So I think there's plenty of evidence that we've used it historically.
Mm-hmm. So I'll just jump right into it. Richard, as an attorney who's used to defining words for us, Stephanie has introduced the word adverse possession, and I looked it up the last night to get a little bit of a background, and the whole concept of adverse possession has been in existence in common law for over 800 years throughout Europe, and it's been a common concept for all states in the United States of America, including Alaska, and it has been an active concept up until about 2003 when we changed things. But would you define that for us, adverse possession, and what that process is? Apparently, it's a process of attaining a title to land that you didn't buy, I guess, or inherit, or is not your own.
Well, yes, it is. In fact, one case I had representing adverse possessor, the owner, threatened my life because I was representing I was taking his land away to give it to the adverse possessor. And so it's a controversial concept, yet it's believed that land should not sit idle. You know, if people just abandon their land, supposedly, and someone comes who needs land and sits on it uninterrupted, continuously for 10 or 7 years, depending on the situation, and it's notorious. In other words, he puts up a fence and he makes all the outward indications of owners, of an owner. And let's see, what was the third one here? Adverse
interests
and notorious.
Interests are controversial. To the owner.
Yeah. So if he complies with the three requirements, then he's entitled to adverse possession.
One of the things that I learned about in 2003, Senate Bill 93 was introduced, and I thought it was really an ironic situation because even though it wasn't introduced, the legislation wasn't sponsored by Sea Alaska Inc., nonetheless, the history of the issue coming to the legislature was brought forward by Sea Alaska. And when that was first told, when I first learned of that, I thought it was because being Alaska Native without a cultural history of land ownership as Europeans understand land ownership, I would have thought that the issue of adverse possession would have been argued to allow adverse possession so that especially the access to resources was there for the public. Because it was a traditional use or a subsistence use issue. But ironically, it was actually brought forward because Sea Alaska became the owner of so many acres of land, and they didn't want to have to patrol it or make sure that, you know, to monitor it to make sure that there weren't squatters on it. And what I learned was in 2003, that whole issue was brought up because, especially in the interior part of Alaska, squatting is an issue. Now, I don't know that locally we have squatting issues, but I think that maybe in Mr. Einsbrook, I do want to hear more about your issue. It has to do more with not, you know, ownership so much, but just transport across.
Well, before Fred speaks, is Stephanie. I'd like to sort of support the idea of access to our navigable waters, which I thought is what we were going to talk about, and that is a right that's in the Constitution, and it says free access to the Constitution of the State of Alaska, free access to the navigable or public waters of the state, as defined by the legislature, shall not be denied any citizen of the United States or resident of the state. And this is in the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and it explains that we all have access to our navigable waters. And the city of Haines, when it was the city of Haines, did survey all of its lands and identify the access routes to the navigable waters. And so it is important to provide that access. We're required to provide that access. The problem arises when people have private land that interferes with that access, interrupts that access. And I really, you know, I think that is the proper introduction to Fred's issue is, and it's not so much adverse possession, but it is because it's a prescriptive easement that's really desired, and that is in itself controversial. So the person isn't looking for title to the land. They're not wanting to take possession of the land, but they're looking for the right to cross the land in order to access the water. So that there comes the problem, and it's the issue, not so much. I'm sorry, I introduce adverse possession, but that's what arises when you mention Picture Point, because people don't go to Picture Point necessarily to access the water. They go to Picture Point to stand there and take pictures. But the issue that I believe Fred is concerned with is that access across private land to the water. So maybe that's a good introduction to you, Fred.
Go right ahead, Fred.
There's two sort of issues wrapped around adverse possession. One of them is actual possession and taking title to a property, which the legislature did highly restrict in 2003. Prior to 2003, if you had went somewhere and built a cabin somewhere and lived there and improved it and done it in an open, notorious fashion for, let's say, 10 years, I think, was the statutory period, then you would actually have the right to go seek a title for the property and actually get a title for, like, the actual area of the property that you use, not necessarily the whole piece of property that you were sitting on, but the actual area that you improved and used. And the legislature changed that in 2003, and they modified that so only an adjacent property owner could do that. So let's say I had a piece of property and I built a house that straddled the property line, or maybe was on my next door neighbor's property, and if I did that in good faith and it went 10 years and the owner didn't interfere with me, then I could eventually acquire title to that little piece of property that adjacent to me. But that doesn't affect prescriptive easement. A prescriptive easement is a concentration on the use of the property, which is typical of some of the situations we have here, where people may have parked and crossed a piece of property to access the beach, or left boats above a high tide line, harvested seaweed, and just kind of general use of a property rather than possession of the property. So that's a second form of adverse possession, which is quite a bit easier to acquire than the possession of the property. Mm-hmm. The right of use is a lower standard to acquire. Mm-hmm. And additionally, with a prescriptive easement, you can acquire a public prescriptive easement, which is based on the public use of the property over the statutory period, not just an individual's use. So for adverse possession, you normally have to prove exclusive use of the property. So if I was going to possess a property and seek a title, I have to maintain exclusive use to myself. Where a public prescriptive easement can be based on the overall public use of the property over an extended period of time.
Right.
And Dick might know about the Homer case that was recently resolved with the snow machine and the prescriptive easement across Mr. Price's land in Homer that was recently settled. It took many, many years.
Well, that case is Price versus Eastham. It's a pretty dominant case in Alaska case law now, where Price, I think, was the guy. Price owned – he didn't even own the property. He acquired a agricultural interest from the state of Alaska, which sort of gives him possession and right of use but not outright ownership of the property. And apparently there was a trail on the property that these snow machiners had been using for, like, since the 50s apparently. And again, what classically happens is you have this, like, new ownership situation, and the new owner say, hey – stop crossing my property. And then the users, react and say, no, we've been doing this for a long time. We've acquired the right to continue doing it. And that's what happened in this Price versus Eastham case. And, they went through some legal wrangling. They formed a group, and initially it was rejected because they said the group didn't exist during the statutory period. But later on, they just refiled it under the names of the individuals of the group, and they were clearly able to show that they had used the property for a statutory period of time, open and notoriously, and that the interests were adverse to the owner, and they did achieve their prescriptive easement, which is, a classic case now used in other prescriptive easement cases.
Mm-hmm.
Price versus Eastham is a classic
case.
And
what about the case in Juneau with the Girl Scouts and
Girl
the
Scout Council. Yeah. What was the name of that one? It was
somebody versus the Girl Scouts.
Yeah, versus Girl Scouts.
Girl Scouts have been collecting clams.
Yeah, that was an actual claim for adverse possession where I think the guy was might have had Native history, and many, many, many years ago, his grandfather kind of said, okay, this property's yours, you can have it. And then he used it, you know, as his own, and he might have built a cabin, and they did, like, their fish drying, and they had fish camps there, and they did various, I don't know all the details, but they used it as their own, and he did, like, maintain some exclusivity to it. And then the issue was brought up, well, you let, like, clammers come and dig clams on the beach, and, you know, that was determined to be, like, what a normal owner might do. If you had a piece of property and people
right.
came to
he
dig some clams, yeah,
that's
you might
what
say, yeah,
said.
Have a ball. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So right. that mm-hmm. didn't terminate his rights, the fact that he allowed other, mm-hmm. you know, some others to do some clamming mm-hmm. or something there. And I think it was Peters, maybe. His name was Peters versus Girl Scout Council,
yeah.
but that's
right.
another classic case mm-hmm. where he prevailed. Mm-hmm. And that was actually in Tea Harbor in Juneau. So
right.
that's like this classic, you know, really right down home case.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he prevailed, and I assume his heirs and whatever have the possession of the property today.
I'd like to go back to Stephanie's point that was brought up earlier about the responsibility, I guess, of governments to provide easements. And I think that you know we are talking about ways in which that can be provided. We've identified that obviously you can purchase land from an owner. Our comprehensive plan has in areas, especially related to recreation and subsistence and the promotion of trails, which is kind of an economic development strategy for our tourism-based economy, the comprehensive plan calls for, you know, the acquisition of easements or even for, you know, purchase. I guess outright purchase might be a way to effect that. But at this point in time, I'm unaware that we have any anything in motion to start identifying where we might need easements in the Haynesboro. And I want to attach on to that also the issue of the not just to the ocean, beaches, but also in the Chilkat River. I have heard, I didn't research this, but I heard that the issue of boat launch in the Chilkat River has come up as part of the road, the highway project to allow for boat launch in the river, and that can be problematic also.
Well, the reason that comes up is because of the Bald Eagle Preserve, and the only reason you want to design intentional boat launch areas is to protect the habitat, not at all to restrict access, but it's a habitat issue. But for instance, going back to the public policy in the Homer case, it became a public prescriptive easement, and the Department of Natural Resources was the public owner of that easement. And so, to me, the public policy issue is, what is the public entity that then takes responsibility for that easement, and what does that cost? I mean, to maintain the easement, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I see, you know, the underlying cost to monitor these potential public easements to land, and I think that we always have to be mindful of that. So I think that that's a public policy issue.
Yeah, but you could compare that to the cost of not having access too. So it's obviously far, far lower of a cost to acquire an easement and than there is the cost. You know, the cost to the public of losing a public access is pretty high.
And I think if we can identify a Portage Cove, for instance, I mean that's something that's clearly been talked about on several, you know, public forums, the desirability of having a beach walk along Portage Cove, a beach walk from, you know, Battery, not Battery Point, but the the park, the state park here on the point, through
the
all the
camping
way
area
the
there.
Campground, right, and Portage Cove Campground all the way across to Nuktic Point. I mean, that was discussed as part of the argument for, but it was a direct benefit of owning Nuktic Point would be able to provide that walk. Now, acquiring the right to build that walk in a certain way, that would become a public policy would direct how we go about doing that. And, you know, I suppose that one could argue that we have the public has access to the beach without, I mean, posting of signs, you know, telling, you know, there aren't signs posted in Portage Cove right now saying that.
Right.
Access
but,
yeah, is
but,
denied.
But I think like you really have to be careful because, you know, it might be subtly not, you know, obvious to people, but really the public has lost the right to park at the cruise ship dock now. Okay, all the cruise ship dock, they did a big renovation there. They took some of the beach, you know, to a lot of protest of some people. And now it's like commercial parking only in there.
Mm-hmm.
So it used to be public parking there.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, you know, so there you go. We've lost, you know, public access right there, right in front of our eyes.
Okay, but I also, let me advocate for a minute that I think that is an issue where a decision had to be made about how the public would best be served. Would the public best be served to have a dedicated space for commercial parking? And I think because there's a cruise ship dock there. I mean, you can't expect
right, but it makes
parking.
No sense to me to have 24/7 exclusion of the public when you got a cruise ship there one day a week for, you know.
Okay, well that I
for
think
13
that's,
weeks a
okay.
year. Okay,
and I think so you're that, right to bring that up because I think that can be dealt with. That's a scheduling or a managing.
You know, maybe
issue.
When cruise ship is present might be a more appropriate sign.
Right,
you know.
Right. Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that you know I'd like to point out is that. Some huge percentage of the land in the Haynesboro belongs to the public. It is either the Bureau of Land Management, federal ownership, or it's the state of Alaska, either parks or DNR. A very, very tiny percentage of our land is in private ownership. And so really the public access question can be solved. It's the land is already in public ownership. And so what we need to do is to make sure that when and if that land is developed by the public or sold, that access be retained, so the public can have access to the waterways. And then you have to be reasonable. I mean, it can't just be access where I want access to be or where I'm used to accessing the water. That's not the rule. It's just that there be public access and so in some reasonable location. So I think that there's plenty of room to resolve the access issues if there are. And what the Planning Commission for the Haynesboro needs to do is to identify the access points, the traditional access points to the waterways, mm-hmm. and then see if they're sufficient and perhaps, you know, have a public meeting to discuss those access and go from there.
One of the things I thought was interesting, and it was brought up in an October editorial from the Choctaw Valley News, that in Hawaii, that the state of Hawaii, I don't know how they did this administratively, but the state actually purchased strips of land. I think it was 8 feet wide or something like that, so that you know people with their surfboards could access the surf through areas that were developed for commercial recreation sites or residential areas or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, that kind of shows a concerted plan, forward-thinking method.
Let me just comment on that, Deborah. So if you look at the history of the United States, you know, as we moved west, you know, and time went on, we became more aware of these issues. So if you go back to the East Coast, where I happen to be from, there's a huge issue there where the Hudson River Valley and the Hudson River, which is really this huge estuary down, it's not really a river in most places that people think of the Hudson River. It's really this estuary. all the access was bought up by the railroads years and years ago. And so now today in the Hudson River Valley, you know, they're fighting for these little pieces of access that they can get because, the railroad totally took it over in the day, you know what I mean, when people, weren't that aware of it. You know, New York was way down there and no one really cared. And so as we move west, there's more and more awareness of, need for this public space. So, California and Oregon and Washington and even Alaska are more modernly developed and there's more, opportunity there to save these public access places where, in the older places of the East, they were largely acquired by public interests, long ago,
mm-hmm.
for the awareness of the need for that mm-hmm. recreation, public recreation and access.
And one of the things, too, I don't want to lose sight of the idea that it's not simply for recreation for us. I mean, subsistence mm-hmm. is especially
it's huge
right.
here.
But I'd like to ask Richard Folta, in Alaska and I suppose elsewhere, individuals, there can be private ownership of tideland areas, correct? How and tell me what the laws are. I mean, generally, you can assume that there's public ownership, except when.
Of course, as you know, the municipalities can have ownership to tidelands. The state gives out leases to private individuals, but they are very hesitant in giving out any private ownership on the tidelands to individuals or private interest. But
because you hear of people owning tidelands, right?
Well, there were lands given, especially quite a while ago, to companies, gold mining companies and shipping companies, mm-hmm. who purchased land from the territory, but I'm not aware of any private parties actually purchasing tidelands.
Okay,
it's all leased now.
Okay, yeah. So and it's the was I accurate before when I stated that it was a mean high tide?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah,
and so that generally is. Well, wherever you see the seaweed, right?
Well, that's the high tide now. That's the high tide line.
Not
the
mean high tide.
Not the mean high tide. And mm-hmm. also, I think another confusing issue here is that, we're rising out of the ocean. So what used to be the mean high tide mm-hmm. 40 years ago, is no longer necessarily the same line. It's probably 40 inches, in a vertical direction different. So, that can be pretty confusing mm-hmm. when you have these mm-hmm. accretion issues and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So mm-hmm. That further adds to the confusion.
Okay.
The accretion surveys I've done and other surveyors, the state requires that there be public access, even though the land, accreted land, is in front of your private property. There still has to be access to the beach.
Do they do you survey in a prescriptive easement then?
We did in Mud Bay.
Uh-huh. It's not really prescriptive. It's an actual easement that's yeah. deeded easement there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, like a 15-foot easement for a trail along the beach kind of thing.
Okay. And one of the issues is signage. People mm-hmm. don't know that these easements exist, and that's one of the things that, has been identified by the state of Alaska, and that may help people understand mm-hmm. that they do have access and if they know where it is.
I'd like to just clarify first, there was an exchange a moment ago, easement versus prescriptive easement. Would you clarify that for us, Richard? A prescriptive easement is one...
Mm-hmm. That's a kind of a right-of-way, a state, a federal roadway or trail that after 10 years, that becomes a ripe. An easement usually refers to a private, an easement across private property, whereas prescriptive is a public easement.
And is a prescribed easement is one as... how do you say it? it's not necessarily purchased, but an easement can be purchased. Not a prescribed one is prescribed by the court,
right.
And an easement can be purchased by the individual.
Right.
Okay.
So let me ask a question. So if there were an area of the borough that private property came right down to the, you know, mean high tide mark, and people had been using it traditionally, could the borough purchase from the landholder an easement for the public?
Certainly.
That would be if it were agreed upon.
Yeah.
Okay.
I might mention you talked about purchase. However, when you get adverse possessor or someone trying to get prescriptive rights or an easement, you usually have to go into a quiet title action to litigate the question of title and rights and whether it's adverse possession or not. If you're an owner and someone's squatting on your property, then you're talking about ejectment. You want to get rid of the trespasser. So that's the legal step for that phase.
Mm-hmm. That's usually relating to somebody who's actually squatting on the
right.
property.
Yeah.
And it's not the issues that I think that some of us
no,
are...
No, even the right of use is the same issue. So,
okay.
So we
right.
clearly have an issue in town where people are, you know, contesting the right of use and, you know, taking a lot of action against each other in the right of use.
Mm-hmm. So do you as an advocate, Fred, do you think that a way for the community to deal, to mitigate the contentiousness of the access issues is to have more, I'll just leave it open. What do you think that the approach would be?
Well, I think the first approach is to recognize that there's probably relatively few areas in the borough, although there are some, you know, where this historic traditional use has been going on. And I think that, I think if everyone educates themselves as to the actual law and you understand that there is a potential for an acquired prescriptive easement in these places, I think that would go a long way toward, you know, reducing the contentiousness of it. When you realize this is a real thing, there's a real right of use that can be acquired by the public over time, and the three requirements to achieve these prescriptive easement is relatively simple and clear. It's like 10 years use, open and notorious use, and that the use is adverse to the owner. So, I mean, those are not that high standards, and it's easy to see where those things are happening.
One of the things I'd like to bring up, though, is that for many landowners, the question of adverse possession is also a question of stewardship of the land. That I know that there are owners of land who might recognize that the public has used their land for a while, but littering becomes an issue. Toxicity, you know, driving trucks across and the drop and spillage of toxic material. So in some ways, there's an argument that adverse possession is a bad policy for the government or for the land. And because stewardship is an important thing. And I talked with owners of property.
Well, the actual adverse possession is actually a penalty for failure to provide stewardship to your land. So that's actually the way it works.
Or development of the land.
No, stewardship. So if you are oblivious to the fact that people are using your land for 50 years, then, like, you're not doing anything. You're not living there. You're not taking care of it. You're not doing anything. So – you know, the acquiring of a prescriptive easement is quite literally like a penalty for failure to provide stewardship to your property.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's an understandable thing. When I know that there's an issue that I heard rumors flying about access issues in the Chilkoot, in the Lutac area. And I talked to Rosalie Lowen about whether or not she was denying access through her property to a traditional hooligan fishing area.
Mm-hmm.
And she's She wrote a letter, and I just want to read it because I think it's important to clarify her position, because I know there's statements out there that go against what she is saying. She said it would be impossible for anyone to block access to the spawning grounds because it's a tidal river. DOT has a large swath of right-of-way, and because of the mix of public, private, and native ownership, among other reasons, the access to that area is guaranteed. That's something you spoke about there, Stephanie. I'm uncertain as to why anyone might believe that access is a possible issue. I do believe that every member of the community has a role to play in helping to ensure that this area remains vibrant and healthy for generations to come. As part of that, I think it's wise to discourage people from driving directly onto hooligan spawning grounds, as this increases the likelihood of contaminating the water with oil and other toxins, which is obviously harmful to the hooligan, as well as the salmon and everything else in the river. So for me, that was just kind of a reminder that that stewardship is an important part of land ownership, and owner, you know, just to reinforce what you are saying, that that it's important for people to maintain their stewardship, but also at the same time, when public access is not governed somehow, that it can be a difficult situation too. So
I just want to point out that, you know, if you acquire the rights of prescriptive easement or adverse possession somewhere, I mean, it only gives you like the legal rights to do things. You can't go there and do illegal things like littering, or if, you know, driving on the beach is illegal or something. I mean, so you don't acquire any rights to do anything illegal. So, I mean, it's illegal to litter. Period. So it doesn't,
or drive your truck in the river.
Yeah, I assume. I'm not an expert in that little caveat, but if it is, then it's illegal. So, you know, it's you know, the prescriptive issue doesn't obviate anybody, you know, from their responsibilities to be a citizen. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Oh, boy. And I, you know, just to back up to the policy question, so then this problem really has emerged in Alaska because mostly in the urban areas. There are some of the site assessments for access to navigable waters in Alaska shows that there is public access for every 12 miles of the Alaska coastline. And when we had an Alaska Coastal Management Program, all of this information was compiled. And the press is coming in urban areas, and even though Haines isn't urban, we are growing. Our population is continually, we're continuing to get more people, and I think that this issue arises from our increased density of population. And if for instance, there were a prescriptive easement for public access across my property, that would make me the regulator, basically, of the public's behavior, and it's a burden on the property owner to have that role, and I'm not comfortable assigning as a policy assigning that role to an unwilling private property owner. We have a hard time regulating people.
Right, and I think people don't want that responsibility. I think
exactly.
You're exactly right, and that's why it's easier sometimes to just, you know, put a fence around and just say, I don't want to deal with it, because, you know, that's where I think most people finally land. But I do think, Stephanie, that, and I'm sure, I know that you agree with me on this because you've stated it here, that it is a public policy issue, and in our community, as we become more densely populated, and as people who, you know, haven't, for lots of reasons, developed their land that they've held quietly for many, many years, you know, come to town in their retirement years and say, now I'm going to build on this property, and find out that while they were gone or while they were absent, it was being used. Those issues are going to rise for us, and we do have to address them.
You know, I really hope that we'll dust off the City of Haines report. They received an enhancement grant, and they were funded to identify the highest valued public use areas within the boundaries of the city of Haines, consider all appropriate uses, and develop an access management plan. And so we have that document.
Excellent.
Is that the city or the city and borough?
No, it was the former city of Haines. And
so
that's
10 years old.
That's a starting place.
Absolutely.
And it's a template for what we might generalize to the borough. So a lot of our work is done.
All right. Well, on that, I mean, that's a great place to wrap this up for this this morning's session. And thank you very much, all of you. I think that we learned a lot about things we didn't know about before. And I appreciate your contributions to the discussion of public access.
Thanks
a lot.
Thank you very much, Deborah.
Thank you.
My name is Jamie Sykes.
Hi, Jamie.
Hi. Thank you for having me today.
Oh, you bet. I'm so glad that you joined us. So tell us about yourself. What do you want us to know about you?
Well, my name's Jamie Sykes. I've lived in Haines for 25 years. I graduated from Haines High School in 2003. My grandma, Barbara Woods, lived here. She moved here in 1989 and followed my Aunt Marge Canzotti.
Oh.
And she called my mom and said, "You guys have to come check this place out." We came up and we never left. So,
I'm glad you clarified that because I thought you had possibly been born here. How old were you when you got here?
I was 4 years old.
Four, okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So this is home and this is where I'm raising my kids now. Mm-hmm. I've been married to a gentleman I met here from Florida for 6 years and we have 3 kids. One going into the fourth grade, one going into the first grade, and one going, well, she'll be 2 in July. So that's exciting.
You're a pretty high-profile person in the community now with your position at the Haines Chamber of Commerce.
Yes, so
tell us about that.
I absolutely love my job. I am the office manager for the chamber, mm-hmm. and I love being part of helping promote the business community. I think it's really important, and I love being part of helping those businesses get business in the doors and all about it. So mm-hmm. it's absolutely wonderful.
How did you develop that interest? I mean, you went through the Haines school system, right? And mm-hmm. now here you are, office manager. What pulled you into that that job, I guess, and what attracted you to apply there?
I absolutely love Haines. I love Haines. I love teaching people about Haines. I think it's a great place to raise your kids and a great place to live. The people here are absolutely wonderful. The business community is just great. They support many different organizations through the community, and I think it's important for people to support our business community, and I've always wanted to be part of that. And
Have you ever started a business of your own?
I personally haven't. No. It's I'm more about, I like to promote what's here, help promote mm-hmm. what's here. And the Haines is just such a great place to live and raise kids and visit and be from that I just love it here. And I love teaching people about the different services that are here and different opportunities. And it's just, I just love it.
What do you do when you're not working?
We do a lot. We do a lot of family activities. We go fishing. My kids absolutely love fishing. They don't really like to be in town. They want to be by the river.
Uh-huh.
So we do a lot of fishing and berry picking and driving around the mountains, mushroom picking, and it's just great fun.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much, Jamie, for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. And I think that's, we're done. And that's it for Talk Around Town this week. Thanks to our guests, Tom Morfitt, Stephanie Scott, Richard Folta, Fred Einsbrook, and Jamie Sykes-Knudsen. Next edition of Talk Around Town will be right here on this station, KHNS, on June 6th. Stay tuned. This is station KHNS 102.3 FM, Haines.